Hello, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. You weren't expecting that, were you? But you know the tune. It's the popular theme for the TV series about celestial journeyman Doctor Who. Since 1963, we've watched him gallivanting about in space-time. Such is the hold of space travel on our popular imagination. It's the International Year of Astronomy. So today we're strapping on our spacesuits and blasting into space for an intergalactic adventure. We'll skip from Mars to Venus on our Stardust with some astronomical writers who'll shuttle us from space operas to finding words to explain cosmic magnetism. So come with me into the TARDIS. Cyrano de Bergerac, that 17th century French writer with a big nose, is considered one of the earliest science fiction writers. He wrote about the sun, the moon, and time travel, but writing about the stars and astronomy go way back. In the 2nd century AD, Ptolemy of Alexandria wrote the Almagest, which was an astronomical treatise. So from alternate worlds to The Little Prince, today we're having a stellar writing discussion with Dava Sobel, Brian Gainsler, and Greg Baer. Dava Sobel has been a science journalist since the 1970s. She's most known for her books Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. She's an eclipse chaser, and she's had an asteroid named after her. She also edited The Best American Science Writing in 2004. She joins us from Long Island in New York. Welcome to The Book Show, Dava.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
And we're also joined by Brian Gainsler, who's a professor of physics at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy at the University of Sydney. He received the Hubble Fellowship by NASA, was associate professor at Harvard, and now his research interest is on cosmic magnetism. He also writes about his research in popular science magazines like Cosmos and Australasia Science. He joins us from Sydney. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning, Ramona.
And in Seattle is Greg Baer. He's won 2 Hugos as well as 5 Nebula Awards for science fiction and quite a few other awards too. While he's lately been more interested in biology, his science fiction intersects with mathematics, physics and astronomy in books like Forge of God, Eon and Moving Mars, and his latest is called City at the End of Time. He's also written a Star Trek and Star Wars book. Welcome to The Book Show, Greg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's begin with looking up. Let's begin with stargazing. Now, Copernicus talked about the ballet of the planets in the heliocentric universe, a very poetic phrase, and gazing at the stars does create a sense of wonder. Now, Dava, your wonder started very early as a child, which you describe in the beginning of your book, The Planets. What was it about the planets that so delighted you?
Well, I used to love the fact that there were 9 of them, but now there aren't anymore. So I have to find a new reason. I love the idea of other worlds, of alternate possibilities, and the strangeness of them. When I was a child, we used to think that Mars actually had vegetation, and that the reason it changed its appearance over the course of the year or 2 years was that plants were growing and then dying off in the cold weather. But now the big focus at Mars is on water, finding water there.
So what about you, Brian? I believe you wanted to be an astronomer when you were 3. And I was thinking to myself, 3? Is that because of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, How I Wonder What You Are?
Oh, I think it goes back before that. I actually don't remember when I just first decided I wanted to be an astronomer, but it's the only thing that I ever wanted to be. I think I was terrified of being bored, and the idea of a book that never ends, of a map that never has any edges, was incredibly appealing to me from a very early age. And even now, I'm comforted by the fact that every time I answer a question, I've opened up 10 more puzzles that also need to be solved.
So are you saying that you had an idea of infinity before you were 3?
Not so much infinity, but the idea that there are things that we just don't know. When you're a young kid, you sort of ask your parents and they normally know the answer. And if they don't know the answer, they'll say, ask a teacher. And I guess these days, if your teacher doesn't know, you can ask the internet. But the idea that there are things that nobody knew, that there are things that are still to be figured out that you can't just look up in a book was incredibly exciting to me.
What about you, Greg? You came to science fiction in your teens, but what was it about other worlds that drew you?
Well, I came to science through the imagination. So, you know, movies with monsters in them, books, comic books. I remember reading one of the first novels of interstellar adventure, The Skylark of Space by Edward E. Smith, when I was 12 years old. And the whole wonder of the universe kind of, you know, just fills these stories. And then I realized around the same time that there's also facts behind them and different, you know, theories. And so I started exploring those, and I was reading about relativity and astronomy, certainly by the time I was 11 or 12. By the time I was 15, I was hooked.
You did some astronomy, I read, at university.
Well, I tried, and then I flunked calculus, and that was the end of that. Turns out I'm much, much better at the very higher maths, the very highest maths of all, theoretical math, rather than actually getting down and working the equation.
Is that so?
Oh, yeah. I can fool people into thinking I'm a great mathematician if they read my books, or even a physicist. One of my early editions of Eon, the publisher put on the back that I had PhDs in physics and math, and that's simply not true. I'm an English major, so it's fun to impress people with new ideas to kind of spur the discussion by working at the highest level, but I really am not probably capable of working either in a laboratory or, you know, doing the hard work of figuring out the calculus.
But you do work with words, and let's now talk about finding the words to explain the almost indescribable, I suppose. Brian, you talk about the beauty of the Milky Way and how you imagine it as a magnetic spiral. Is it the mystery of what's out there that gives you the inspiration to translate it into language that more people can relate to? Is that why you try and act as a bridge almost between your work as an astronomer and telling people why it's so fantastic?
I think there are two sides to this. One side is that the universe is understandable, I mean, which is quite amazing. There's no reason why it should be, but it is. And so one thing that I think is a big motivation for writing is to say to people who might not have PhDs in physics or in astronomy, hey, there are things that you can understand. I can explain to you, leaving out all the gory details of the equations, how a star works or what a black hole is. And so I think that's a very appealing idea for the public, that they can take their everyday knowledge and use it to understand a bit of the universe. But the other exciting part of that is that there are parts of the universe that are very exotic and very strange and don't make sense. And it's also, I think, a thrill to explain to people that there are things that are out there way beyond what we're used to or what we can understand that we're still trying to figure out.
Well, your current research is in cosmic magnetism. Tell me what it is.
So we all know what a magnet is, but we probably don't realize that magnetism is something that naturally occurs in space. The Earth is magnetic, the Sun is magnetic. We now know that the entire Milky Way is magnetic, and that we're beginning to suspect that the entire universe is magnetic as well. So I like to think of it as a bit like the Force in Star Wars. It's this invisible field that binds the universe together. And the problem is that magnetism is something that leaks away. If you throw a magnet on the floor and stomp on it, it will stop becoming magnetic. And the universe is a very violent, energetic place, and so you'd think that all the magnets in the universe would be smashed around and kicked and have their magnetism leak away. And yet the big puzzle is that the universe is quite magnetic, and we're trying to figure out how it got that way and what is keeping it that way.
And when we talk about dark matter, it makes up something like 85% of what's out there, and you say we can't explain it or see it. And I'll read out what you wrote. You wrote, "And so the stars we realise are not scatter like random dust across the universe, rather like trophies of some cosmological spoker. Galaxies have been carefully pinned onto the cosmic web at the positions where the dark matter filaments mesh together." But by writing for a lay audience in a sort of storytelling style, do you ever feel that by not using the technical language, your peers might be critical of your science? I mean, I'm just thinking there about audiences who you're writing for. Because when you're still a scientist, you do have all your peers behind you going, what? You know, but you haven't accounted for this or that other thing.
It's sort of the scientific tall poppy syndrome. If a scientist actually abandons their scientific research and focuses full-time on popular science, there's a bit of a backlash. One of the people I admire most is Carl Sagan, but I think a lot of scientists at the time didn't respect him as much as I felt they should, because they felt that he sort of dumbed things down too much and spent too much time trying to explain it to the public rather than focusing on his equations. But I really feel strongly that taxpayers are funding my salary and my research, and I have an absolute responsibility to tell them what they're spending their money on and why it's worth being spent. So I think all scientists should divide their time between the abstruse equations and the papers that only 8 or 9 people in the world might read, and their popular account that helps people understand what we do and why it's worth doing.
Well, David, part of the popularity of your books is that you've been able to tap into a fascination with astronomy and present it in a suspenseful way. How did your interest in astronomy, but also other kinds of science, crystallise into the desire to write about it as a journalist?
I had been interested in it from childhood. My mother was a chemist, and if I asked a question at home, I got a real answer. And certainly nobody in my family thought it was odd or unusual for a girl to be interested in science. So I had a lot of encouragement. And I was interested in science from an early age. But I would like to add that I attended a lecture given by Carl Sagan before he was famous that really changed my life. And I think I certainly agree with Brian that Sagan did a tremendous service, even though he was criticized for it, for writing in a popular way. But he actually created an entire generation of astronomers. And
what was it about that lecture that really spoke to you?
He was talking about the discovery of planets of other stars. This was in the very early 1970s, a discovery that actually has come to pass in the 90s. We astronomers have discovered about 300 planets of other stars. And at the time, Sagan and other astronomers were wondering what other solar systems would look like. And I remember he presented diagrams of what their layout might be. And they all looked pretty much like our solar system. And what's interesting now that the discoveries are being made is that they don't look anything like our solar system, that things are even more diverse and more interesting.
What do you mean they don't have things going around a sun?
Well, they do, but in our solar system, there are small rocky worlds close to the sun, and then there are great big gaseous planets farther out. And in lots of the systems that have been discovered, the gigantic things with planets many times the size of Jupiter are right up close to the star. And that was a surprise.
Let's talk about some of the emotions while I have you there, Deva. You write about your friend Carolyn, who ate the moon, and your jealousy of her.
I'm still jealous.
Tell us about that.
Carolyn was in love with a young scientist who was part of a team analyzing the Apollo lunar samples. And some of those samples just found their way out of the laboratory. And he actually gave her a sample of moon dust. And when she told me that, I remember I was so excited. I wanted her to show it to me right away. But she had already eaten it. You know, it was that time. People were swallowing all sorts of substances. And I think thought it would make her high.
Really?
Yeah.
But it's sort of like, what else would you do with it, Doug?
What else would you do with it?
Well, you've got moon dust. What else would you do with it?
I would have put it in something. I would have had an amulet, a piece of jewelry, something where I could have kept it forever. But that was the difference between us.
Yeah, she's that kind of girl, isn't she?
Yes.
Whatever happened to her?
She married a veterinarian and had 3 children.
Huh. So there you are. So much for the moon dust. I suppose she's very happy, though.
I hope so.
Well, can we talk a little bit about why also the strong emotion around, you know, you mentioned that Pluto was now not a planet.
It's a dwarf planet, yes.
It's a dwarf planet now, not an actual real big one, like you thought. Why do you think people were so upset when Pluto was demoted?
Partly because people don't like change, partly because people my age had grown up with nine planets and they didn't want to see one taken off the list. And a lot of children identify with Pluto because it was known to be the very smallest one. And so children being small rather liked Pluto. And there's just resistance to change. I agree with the scientific decision that Pluto is really more the first world of the Kuiper Belt and not the last world of the planets of the solar system. But the term dwarf planet, I think, is most unfortunate because there are dwarf stars that are really stars and dwarf galaxies that are galaxies. But somehow the dwarf planet Pluto is not a planet. And just as Greg was saying, as an English major, that just doesn't make sense.
Greg, what about the sort of language that you need to use when you're describing things? I mean, you know, some of your work is set on say a moving asteroid or in interplanetary times or in sort of time travel, I suppose. How much a description do you have to do about the science that you're trying to? You're trying to project your readers into this world, but you have to take them from this world that we live in now to that world. How much language, what do you have to do to think about explaining how things work in that new world?
Well, quite a bit, because one of my goals is to convince the experts that at least, you know, this is the beginning of something close to believable. And that means you have to use the poetry of science, which really does have a poetic language structure. There's a lot of metaphor in science. Scientists may not like to admit it, but there's just as much metaphor in science as there is in poetry or literature. We can't describe everything mathematically, certainly not to our friends. So we sit down and do the poetry of it, and that makes it more accessible. So I borrow from what the scientists actually say about their work, and I add to it a little bit. I stretch it a little bit. I say, what are we going to learn in the future that might be interesting? How will this change the way scientists speak and think about things? And many of my characters are scientists. So putting that all together, we get a kind of approximation of the future that in some cases serves as a kind of feedback. I know that science fiction over the years has actually gone around in full circle and influenced the way scientists think, which is fascinating to me. It's kind of I think science fiction is kind of the dream language of science. It's what scientists would like to experience if they had longer lives.
Yes, that is true, that it is so poetic because it's so hard to describe what's going on in a very micro level and a very macro level in anything else other than a metaphor, really, isn't it?
Well, we all function by metaphors. I think it's hard to describe our inner feelings to people, so we use metaphors to describe them. We use temperatures, we use colors, we use, you know, all sorts of things. And then we have the words that we apply commonly to our experiences today. I'm angry, that sort of thing. When we talk about the universe, we talk about vastness, about infinity, about complexity, about chaos, about, all of these things that are really just kind of a replacement words for things that we just barely begin to understand. I think the approach that science fiction uses is very much like the approach that science uses, that the knowledge is not finite. We haven't got it all. We don't know it all. Therefore, what's next? What's the next question? And when we ask that question, will the answer be something we can even begin to understand?
So, Greg, to what extent have you incorporated astronomy and physics into your fiction? Say, in a book like Moving Mars, can you talk about what it's about and then tell us how you've incorporated what we know about astronomy and physics?
Well, for the solid underpinning of Moving Mars back in the early 1990s, I've been writing about Mars for some time and trying to keep track of all of the different geology texts and so on written by it. I'd talked to some of the scientists who were involved in Mars exploration, remotely, of course. And what I put together was a picture in my own mind of a dead planet that had stopped having internal plumes of heat rising and falling, as in the Earth. And I realized that maybe if you shook it up a little bit, you might start those plumes moving again and reenact volcanism and kind of bring the planet alive.
So sort of ECT for planets.
Pardon?
ECT for planets.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you have a sufficient force to kind of wake the planet up from its slumber, you could get something interesting. Then the other side of that was the physics of actually moving the planet, which was very abstruse indeed, very theoretical. I took a notion of the universe as based on information theory, kind of a gigantic computational system, and scientists discover this. And then there's the political side of it, you know, an independent Mars colonized by human beings who have been away from Earth for a long time. An Earth that is kind of like England of old, trying to maintain balance and economy and trying to keep itself safe. All of that put together, you know, makes a mix of political science, of physics, of biology, because we actually do find what life on Mars was like. And somewhat to my shock, it turns out that my description of Mars is still current to this day, where I describe the water being and what the life forms might be like and so on, seems to still be fairly accurate.
But what about the moving of the planet physics?
I don't know whether that's accurate or not. This theory, I call it particle bit structure.
Sounds good.
Very much on the fringes of physics, and I keep getting letters from people asking, well, what is this, and what does this mean? And it basically, I tried to imagine something in the future that was almost a completely different view of physics.
Well, on ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval, and we're talking about astronomical writing with Davis O'Bell, author of the popular science books Longitude, Galileo's Daughter and the Planets, Brian Gainsler, who's Professor of Physics at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy at the University of Sydney, and Hugo, a Nebula Science Fiction Award winner, Greg Bear, whose latest novel is The City at the End of Time. Well, Brian, you read science fiction as a scientist. What science fiction do you like that draws on astronomy?
I actually see science fiction as a break from astronomy. Astronomy, the universe has so many rules. You can't go faster than the speed of light. You can't have a magnetic monopole. There are all these sort of restrictions and rules. It's very constricting. But science fiction allows you to ignore those rules and to break them and to have a bit of fun. So I really enjoy science fiction, which is a good mix between things we know and that we believe in and things that we know just can't work, but let's just do it anyway. And I see it as letting one's hair down and fantasizing rather than focusing on the facts and the rules and the laws.
But as an astronomer, are you bothered by the impossibility of the science in some science fiction, or do you enjoy the what-if element of the genre, or do you just go, oh, that's just not going to work?
I absolutely enjoy the what if. If you want to stick to a realistic astronomy story, then when you have a conversation from one star to another, you say, hi, how are you? And you wait maybe 10 years for the signal to get there, and they say, good, thanks, and then you wait another 10 years for it to get back. Doesn't make for a gripping read or gripping television. Now, there are excellent stories that deal with these issues, and in fact, sometimes the focus of the story is the incredible delay and barrier between the stars. But it also is fun just to suppose, even though you know it can't work, that people can have a conversation between stars or have some sort of galactic empire, and what sort of human conundrums or puzzles or new moral issues might arise from such a situation.
Well, David, so much about the universe is left to the imagination because we know so little about it, from sort of exoplanets, those beyond our solar system, to dark matter. And I guess it's not surprising that this is fodder for the novelist. For your chapter on Mars in the Planets, you read science fiction like the popular Mars trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson. Why did you read that science fiction for the chapter on the Mars meteorite?
For the Planets, which is a story without a hero and without any kind of continuous narrative, I wanted to approach each planet differently from a theme that people would know from their ordinary experience. Even people who were not remotely interested in science would have heard the names of the planets, whether from mythology or astrology, music, any number of ways. And I tied one theme per planet. And Mars is really the science fiction planet. I think your two other guests will agree with me that there's been more science fiction written about Mars than about any other planet. So I
this
wanted
is because
to write...
it's most like Earth, isn't it? Well,
probably,
sort of. Maybe it used to be.
And we are, scientists really are talking about terraforming Mars and turning it into a place humans can live after they've totally trashed the Earth. So it's not even far-fetched anymore to have those conversations. But I wanted to be able to talk about Mars in the lingo of science fiction. And there was a famous rock that came to Earth of its own accord from Mars. These things happen. The rocky worlds get blasted by meteoroids in space, and then their rocks can escape their own gravitational fields and just wander in space. And so bits of the moon and Mars have actually landed on Earth without our bothering to send astronauts in spacecraft to go and collect them. And scientists especially look in Antarctica, because when they see rocks on the surface there, it's likely that they've come from another world. And one of the rocks collected in Antarctica and definitely tested to be Martian had in it some traces of something that looked like it might have been fossil life. And this was huge news in 1996. And so I decided to let that rock tell the story of Mars. And so I read lots of science fiction to get a grounding in what it should sound like and what the character's voice might be. And it was great fun. But that is my only venture into science fiction.
Well, we've heard what Brian thinks about whether he's bothered by impossibilities in the science fiction he's read. What about you, Greg, as a writer of science fiction? Are there times when you've disagreed with astronomers and what they say about the universe?
I think we're coming up on a time when I'm in pretty severe disagreement. I think the cosmology is going through a major crisis right now, and certainly physics is. We've got string theory, which has many beautiful theories in search of a universe that they can inhabit. We've got dark matter and dark energy, which I find fascinating, but we don't know what they are. I think we're on the edge of a modern revolution, kind of like what happened around the turn of the century when Einstein set us on a new course. But we don't have anybody out there yet who's quite willing to make that leap. And so when I say something in City at the End of Time like dark matter is stuff waiting to happen, I'm trying to provoke a discussion. I think that we are on the edge of this multiverse, which string theory claims, but actually goes back much, much earlier than that. The notion of alternate universes, perhaps an infinite number of them. The implications of that are fascinating to me. What would be the physical leaking over between multiple universes and our own? Is dark matter that physical leaking over? There have been, physics speculations going back decades about the possibilities of alternate worlds. But now when we are looking at quantum computing as a possible real industry, then we have to understand that if quantum computing works, it implies that very likely alternate universes are necessary for it to work. And the implications of that just fascinate me. So.
You've written a lot about alternate universes and the end of time.
Yes. And sometimes if you go far enough into the future, you fall into the area of sounding a lot like fantasy. I'm not really convinced that there are any impossibilities per se. There may be barriers that we haven't overcome yet, but the universe is impossibly vast, and we're very young, and I think we've just gotten started on our explorations.
Yeah, I mean, mightn't the leaps of imagination required for writing science fiction, the kinds of things you've just said, be the same kind of leaps of imagination needed to formulate the next big ideas?
I asked that of Stephen Hawking once at a dinner, and his reply was very succinct. He says, I asked him, do your inspirations begin the same place that poetry begins in your mind? And he says, well, of course, but then I have to make them work and make sense. That's kind of the difference, is poetry doesn't have to necessarily make sense. Science fiction has to make more sense, and science has to work.
Sure, but you have to have an idea before you work out a theory about how it could happen.
Absolutely.
And what do you think, Brian? I mean, don't you think that the sort of fictional leaps of imagination are the same kinds of leaps that you might make in the middle of the night where you're trying to nat out something about cosmic magnetism?
Yeah, I totally agree with Greg. You come up with a crazy idea, and that's not easy. But the the science, that's just the first step. Normally, within minutes of coming up with your crazy idea, you think about it and you realize that it can't work. But if you think that it does have some possibility, then as Greg said, you've got to make it work. You've got to see if it can explain everything we already know about, and if it can perhaps explain new things as well. I think with dark matter and dark energy, I mean, those names don't mean anything. You may as well call them the boogie monster. We really have no idea what dark matter or dark energy is. Everything is on the table. There are lots and lots of crazy ideas out there, but you would hope that it is within humanity's capacity to figure out what these things are, and that means that ultimately one of these crazy ideas is going to end up turning out to be right. And it's just as likely that that idea about dark matter or dark energy, the first seed that turns out to be the theory, could just as easily be planted by an author as it could be by a scientist or a physicist. So I think with this issue that we don't even know where to start, there are no rules about what sort of ideas you should put on the table. I think anything is an option.
Well, Dava, we've always looked up and told ourselves stories about things that we don't understand, like dark matter and cosmic magnetism, for example, but mythology is populated by the stars. The gods of the ocean and war we know of as Neptune and Mars. To what extent do you think that heavens have influenced our stories from oral storytelling to the written word?
Oh, I think every culture has stories about the stars and how the world began. It's the first story that people tell to try to account for why there's something instead of nothing and how people came to be. So the heavens are definitely inspirational. And earlier in time, you could actually see them. These days, it's a worry. We're especially concerned in this International Year of Astronomy about preserving the dark sky so that the current generation of children can actually know what the Milky Way looks like. These are real concerns in our day.
Don't you sometimes just look up, as I do, and just imagine myself as a hunter-gatherer or somebody who doesn't really know very much astronomy and just think, well, how would I get to where we are now? What thought processes might I need to do to try and work out stuff like, you know, what's going around what? Is it, you know, am I the centre of the universe here on Earth or not? And what shape is the, do the planets go in? Is it round? Is it elliptical? And then beyond, I mean, it is gobsmacking, isn't it? What do you think, Greg?
Oh, absolutely. I like the phrase too. I mean, that's about as good a description as anything. I am totally wonderfully baffled by reality. There's so much fun to play with here in mystery and so on. And of course, as a science fiction writer, I don't have to be quite as responsible as a scientist, so the fun just endlessly multiplies. But I've often found it fascinating to talk with physicists a lot of physicists in my acquaintance have read science fiction, and so they don't mind talking to science fiction writers. More and more biologists the same, and and my privilege to discuss these things with the people who are actually doing the hard work and get their opinions and their feedback, and it just expands my whole view of what the potential is. I think the universe is, I can't find the quote in my mind right now as to actually said this, but it might have been Haldane, not only stranger than we can imagine, but stranger than we can possibly imagine.
Stranger that we can possibly imagine. We can't even imagine that.
All right.
Well, Brian, Michael Collins, one of the Apollo 11 astronauts who went to the moon 40 years ago, said being out in space made him reflect more on the Earth. And we are, of course, a planet hurtling around the sun too. Does looking at the stars make us question who we are and our place in the world?
Absolutely. Dave mentioned that we now know of over 300 planets around other stars, but we're still yet to find anything that might even remotely resemble the Earth. We also have yet to find any sign of life, intelligent, or even just a piece of moss or bacteria on other worlds either.
But we're going to, aren't we?
I hope so.
Well, but we must. I mean, it doesn't make sense otherwise.
But even if we do, I think what's pretty clear is that life and a planet like the Earth are very unusual. It might be unique, hopefully not, but it's certainly very unusual and rare. It makes you clear just what a strange turn of circumstances led to us being here and just how special the Earth is. There might be lots of other planets out there, but this is the only one like ours.
This is the only one we've got.
Yeah, I, as much as I love things like Star Trek, where they turn up in a solar system, they say, "Oh, another M-class planet," and you beam down, and there are trees, and there are oceans, and there are people speaking English. That doesn't seem a very realistic description of the universe. The Earth is even more unique than we ever appreciated. There are trillions of stars out there, but there's only one Earth so far, and it's special. We don't know why things happen the way they do, but we should be glad they did, and we should look after it.
Well, just before we go, Greg, do you think we're special, or do you think we're not?
I really can't say. I suspect there's a lot of living planets out there. Whether they're Earth-like or not, I don't know. One of the major sources of life may be found in moons with frozen surfaces and liquid oceans buried underneath. We've got a couple of those in our own system that look promising. In which case, those people would have no sense of astronomy whatsoever unless they managed to burrow out through hundreds of kilometers of ice. One of the great puzzles of science, of imagination, is the Fermi paradox. If the universe is full of life and full of intelligent life, then why haven't we been contacted yet? There really is no answer to that because we don't know the parameters of the question, really. We don't know what the different parts of the equation are, how many planets, how many rise to technology, how many fall back, commit suicide. These are huge questions, and they're utterly fascinating to follow through, probably for the next few centuries.
I think so. And Dava, finally, in the last half minute, do you think we're special?
Well, I had the pleasure of working with Frank Drake on a book that was really his life story called Is Anyone Out There? And he is the father of the Drake equation, trying to estimate the number of intelligent civilizations that might populate our galaxy. And the only important question, aside from the fact that, yes, we are special, but once an intelligent civilization arises, does it survive its own technology?
Mm. Okay.
And that's a scary thought.
Well, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thank you all for talking to me on the book show about stars and planets and dark matter and everything. Davis Abell, who's the author of the popular science books Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets, and she also edited 2004 the Best American Science Writing of that year. Brian Gainsler, Professor of Physics in the Sydney Institute for Astronomy at the University of Sydney, and Hugo, a Nebula Science Fiction Award winner, Greg Baer, the author of many novels, including Eon and The Forge of God and Moving Mars, and his latest is called City at the End of Time, and we'll put a link to all of their websites on ours. Thank you all for being on the book show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ramona.
And our website, of course, is abc.net.au/rn/bookshow.